Again.
You know, Ken, even with all the even if we solve the Niels problem, there still seems to be a problem with your sound. I don't know if there's anything that we can do about that, but
You haven't tried hearing me?
yeah, we
Barry,
haven't
can
been
still hear
hearing you
you.
the whole time, basically. It's
Wow.
worse. It's worse when you have the echo mixed in, but it's already very kind of muffled and hard to hear even without the echo.
It's
Okay.
same thing with me. This is Barbara. Ken, I'm having a problem with always.
Yeah. It's like there's two problems combining when Niels is on and Ken talks. It's like you've got muffled and echoed.
Let me see here if I can figure this out.
Wait a minute, was that Ken talking just then?
No.
No.
That was me.
This is Ken.
I'm gonna try and call Niels here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because whoever was talking was clear, and Ken has not been clear.
Yeah. I mean, the most important thing is that if we get Niels and Don out there being clear, because they're probably going to do most of the talking.
Yeah.
But
Maybe,
Yeah, if Neil comes on, I can always hear him.
if we can't solve the problem with Ken's voice for whatever the technical reason, someone else just temporarily could be the MC.
Yeah, we could do that. Craig can substitute whatever.
Craig could do that.
Sure.
Oh, call failed. Oh, it's
Because,
failed.
and I haven't been able to hear a word you've said.
You didn't hear still, huh?
No.
Well, I could barely hear that.
Well.
It's better when there's no echo, but it's
How about now?
that's a little better.
Is
It's
it better?
better. Yeah.
Okay. All
But
right.
not
I'll
sharp
keep
and
it up.
clear.
What did you do?
I took out the speaker phone.
Oh,
Oh,
my
that does
God.
it. That makes a huge difference.
Anybody
Always.
on a
You'd know
speakerphone at
now,
a
we would have told
conference
you to
is
do it.
asking for trouble.
Yeah, I guess
Yeah.
so.
That's always terrible.
So is there, I'm just wondering if there's any other, are were we finished all the
You
business
know what?
leading up?
I think we could continue with Don's presentation, even with Niels not here. I don't think it's vital to have Niels here for Don's presentation. The points for having Neil will be that we can query him about some of the points that the claims that Don has made. Okay, so why
But
don't we?
shouldn't he hear it though, if he's going to be making responses about it?
Well, actually, most of it's already
Absolutely.
been made, and the claims that we want to have him address have already been stated. So I don't think they'll necessarily be part of what Don is doing tonight, although Don, you can correct me if I'm wrong about that. You're mostly still talking about the making the case for the nuclear demolitions, right? Don? Are you still with us? Don Fox?
Don may be trying to get Niels.
Oh, is Don the one that's trying to get Niels?
I
Yeah, I
think
think
so.
so.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is
Okay.
James. I think we ought to give Neil full chance to hear what Don is saying and respond if he wishes.
I do
Yeah,
too.
I do
Yep.
too.
And since Don, since
If we
Don's
want to
not.
move forward with the agenda, we could always jump forward to agenda item 5, which are updates on any of the topics.
Sure. Let's do that then. Okay, one moment. Okay. We've agreed to keep tabs on various items of constant of ongoing concern. So if anybody has anything update us on any of these items which I'll mention, stop me and we'll listen to your update and then we'll move on. The first one would be any new articles, books, and films on 9/11, which would presumably include anything that you know about Anatomy of a Deception, any updates on that?
So this is Wayne.
Yeah, I'd like to know if you can see that movie, the Great Deception or whatever.
Not yet.
It's already out.
No. So this is Wayne. I'll give you the update. First of all, Anatomy of a Great. Can I go forward?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Anatomy of a Great Deception is scheduled for release in September. There's going to be a launch party in Detroit on September 5th, Friday night. And after that, it'll be available for sale in mostly the Detroit area, the Detroit and Chicago areas. They are trying to pull together a process so that there can be local screenings, kind of like was done with Architects and Engineers 9/11 Explosive Evidence Experts Speak Out on the 10th anniversary, where there were over 100 venues that showed the film. And so that process is being worked on. It's got the support of Architects and Engineers in concept, but it's being handled through the folks who are putting on Anatomy of a Great Deception. It is available for pre-order on the Architects and Engineers website through their store, and there may be a few other places where it'll be available.
Pre-order for what date, Wayne?
Pardon?
Pre-order for what date? What is the date that it will be sold online? When will it be released for iLine 2?
Whoever's speaking isn't coming through at all, only a few tryings here and there.
When would it be shipped? If you pre-ordered, when would it be shipped, do you know?
It would be shipped, I think, about September 1st. I don't think they want anything out before the official screening, which is the 5th, and I believe that they're trying to make arrangements so that the local screenings, if they are scheduled, can begin on that Saturday, September 6th. I'm probably the person that's going to be handling that for the moment. So,
who's speaking? Is this Barton?
This is Wayne Costin.
Wayne Costin.
Oh, Wayne. Yeah, okay. Well, my question was, I've gone to their website.
My
their web-
questions, I can take them.
Yeah, I do have a question, and that is, I'm pretty close to Richard Gage, and I've been emailing him about it, and it's clear that he's seen it, at least an early version of it, and gotten all kinds of feedback back. And I've seen reviews online of people who've seen the early version. So my question is, can we see the early version to get feedback into them?
No, David Hooper has been, first of all, the early version has been substantially revised. Part of the problem is that there were copyrighted materials that he didn't have permission for, and he's updating those. I did see a much earlier version of it, but I've been told that it's been changed. You can go to the website and see trailers of it, but seeing it in its entirety right now, I haven't seen it for quite a long time, and it's been it's no longer publicly available. The older version. Over.
Yeah, this is Craig. This is Craig. I've seen one too. I don't know if it was as far long ago. I wrote an article about it for the AE website, so I saw it maybe not even 2 months ago. But it was definitely a version that I know it's been. I know that that's been changed for sure, as Wayne said. But I did get a chance to see a kind of working version at the time. So I thought it was very good. I thought, it focuses entirely on the World Trade Center. It doesn't deal with other aspects of 9/11, but it does a very good job of it, from what I could tell.
I do have a question maybe Wayne would know about, not only this movie but others. My understanding is that if you aren't going to sell it and make money, which I guess they want to, and have tickets at the door and all that, but if it's just for educational purposes, like if you're just putting it up on YouTube and you're not selling anything, My understanding is from talking to attorneys that you can just have the fair use disclaimer, and you don't have to worry about copyright. But I guess they want to earn money.
They're trying to at least at a minimum recover their costs for doing this.
Yes.
It is not intended to be a freely distributed film, as I understand it, at least for the time being. That's why it is being being held back from public view at this time, and it'll be available for sale. To try to recover some of the costs associated with putting this whole thing together. Over.
Thank you, Wayne. Could I ask if Niels is on the line yet? Has he rejoined us yet, by any chance?
I'm here, Copenhagen.
Yeah, both Niels and I are on. I called Niels and then I called into the conference. So.
Excellent.
This is great.
Excellent.
We can hear you. This is wonderful.
Yeah.
That's great.
Okay.
All right. Then, if that's the case, and we're all able to hear. Let's proceed with our main agenda item, which is a conclusion from Don Fox of his presentation on nuclear demolition theory, and then we'll proceed into the question and answers, which should take up the bulk of the call. Go ahead, Don. Who got you on the call, gave you the introduction the first time? Craig, you want to give them just a real brief introduction for people that may not know him?
Sorry, you're muddled again. Yeah. I don't have that in front of me because I wasn't expecting to do that again. I first wasn't thinking about it. So why don't we let Don introduce himself? That might be better than me trying to struggle for my notes.
Okay, go ahead, Don. Introduce yourself and then conclude your presentation first.
Sure. Okay. I'll just do a quick brief intro for those that are not familiar with me. I'm basically just a regular guy in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I started paying attention to 9/11 probably in about 2004, and I got onto the mini nuke theory probably in early 2005. And I didn't become public at all until late 2011. I got in a debate with some people with Jim Fetzer's group, and then it kind of took off from there. I ended up speaking in Vancouver, and I've got a blog at donaldfox.wordpress.com. All my stuff's free. You don't have to sign up for anything. You're not going to get any emails from me. And several of my articles have been posted at veteranstoday.com. So you can always find my stuff up there as well. And with that, I think I'll just go through some of the notes I've got here, and then we can get into the Q&A part.
Okay,
so I did send this over to Craig, so Craig can get this out to whoever wants to see it, and maybe after the call or during whatever. So my Wednesday note talk here, why nukes? Why do researchers like myself, Jeff Prager, Ed Ward, Dmitry Kolosov, and the anonymous physicist promote the nuclear demolition theory? What do nukes explain that other theories cannot? You know, why not dynamite, RDX, etc., or dews or nanothermite? Certainly conventional charges could have been used to bring down the towers and the other WTC buildings. That's a plausible. It doesn't fit with a big chunk of the evidence, as we'll go through here in a minute. However, the Judy Wood-style dews have never been proven to exist, and as we dig into it, nanothermite does not exist. Until someone can identify a factory where thousands of tons of nanothermite were produced prior to 9/11, that theory can be set aside as well. Okay, so what got me hooked into this at first? The gross observable evidence. I started taking the nuke theory seriously after I saw the Finnish Military Experts website in early 2005. Pyroclastic flow that was observed during the destruction of the Twin Towers in Building 7 is consistent with nuclear detonations. Pyroclastic flow, cauliflower-shaped clouds, are indicative of high-energy events, usually either volcanoes or nuclear explosions. And as you see in the picture below, the explosions on 9/11 are eerily similar to nuclear explosions. So the picture here on the left, it's the Storax underground nuke. And then on the right, we see what I believe that's the North Tower exploding. And I'm sure we can get these notes out to people. Okay, so then one-third of the towers were completely vaporized. That feat alone pretty much proves the nuke theory, that nuclear devices were used. Nothing else known to man can vaporize one-third of a 500,000-ton building in less than 10 seconds. Okay, Father Frank Morales, he was at Ground Zero, and here's his description of what he saw. One, no chairs or desks were found at Ground Zero. The soil was rich and moist from the bodies of the dead. 1,100 bodies were completely vaporized. DNA was mixed in with from different people. They couldn't identify a lot of the people. If the buildings had just collapsed, 1,100 people would not have been vaporized. And Frank noted that very little debris was found compared to what you might expect. Obviously, jet fuel can't explain that. Frank states that the North Tower was referred to as the 2,000-degree pit, and the cherry picker was removing pieces of molten steel from below ground level. And workers were going around with red 1-pound bags, collecting 1-inch or less pieces of bodies. Okay, then the Winter Garden. The Winter Garden atrium was totally destroyed by debris ejected from the North Tower. The North Tower was 600 feet away from the Winter Garden, and as we see, the debris was ejected up at a 45-degree angle. That means it was going out as fast as it was going up. So this completely disproves the crushdown theory that enough other subscribers can believe it or not. And then, then we come here to the Ground Zero pothole. And this is an excerpt from Dmitry Kolosov's book. And Dmitry, his theory is that three 150-kiloton nukes were used, but that I don't subscribe to that. But I do subscribe to underground nukes on 9/11. And Dmitry's 9/11 anthology states, we have independent confirmations of nuclear demolition, molten rock, thermal maps, ice age glaciers, and hard evidence. One might ask probably another question. Are there any independent sources that can confirm that there were indeed three underground nuclear explosions in lower Manhattan, apart from the ravings of the author of these lines and other conspiracy theorists of similar kind? And he was mentioning Mr. Tahill. Firstly, I would like to state that Mr. Tahill claims there were only two underground nuclear explosions, not actually three. This is, by the way, yet another clear indication that he might be closely related to the culprits from the WTC demolition team. If he were an honest researcher, then considering his supernatural shrewdness, he would never fail to notice that the third nuclear demolition event in regard to World Trade Center 7. To answer the actual question, yes, there are some independent sources which indirectly testify to the same effect as the author of these lines. I believe this was in the UK Mail newspaper. The picture is titled, Pictured the 40-foot pothole shows that Ground Zero was once the site of an ice age glacier. And that was published on September 23rd, 2008. The article featured quite an interesting photograph showing the excavated bathtub at Ground Zero, along with an odd giant so-called pothole in the spot of one of the former Twin Towers. Edges of the pothole appeared to be covered in molten rock. There were actually three pictures of so-called potholes, two of them inserted into the above-mentioned article, and one more photo of the same series used in another news article dealing with the same issue. Blow is one of the first two, and Craig's got this, and we'll get it out to everybody. It just shows the fenced-off hole right in the middle of Ground Zero there, and there's workers inside the pothole. So there's a giant cavity 40 feet deep. And then the second one shows, it's a more of a wide angle shot. You can see basically up to the slurry wall, and then again the fence top pothole. They fenced it off so people wouldn't fall, you know, get too close and fall in. And the UK Mail states that this is proof of ice, that it's a giant pothole seen in the lower half of the picture. It's proof the World Trade Center tower stood on what was once ground covered by an Ice Age glacier. And you can really appreciate the description under the above photo. I mean, you could really appreciate the level of desperation of the U.S. government officials and their spin doctors who are tasked, and the near impossible task, to say something comprehensible in regard to the incriminating cavities that had nothing to do with either kerosene nor supposed mini-nukes. Yet, an even more seditious picture was leaked to the public about the same time, and it belonged to the same series of so-called pothole photos. This one was on Science on NBCNews.com in an article named Ice Age Geology Revealed at Ground Zero. World Trade Center dig uncovers a 20,000-year-old 40-foot-deep pothole. And yeah, that article was still up. Looks like my link disappeared, but I've got a link to my blog post, and it's got all the relevant links on it there. And Dimitri states the seditious photo showing smooth edges of molten rock. So there's a worker there in the pothole, and not too far away from his head, you can see these smooth rock formations. These utterly seditious pictures were apparently taken illegally, since it was strictly prohibited to bring any photographic equipment into the Ground Zero area. Even when these words were still spelled with lowercase letters, and where there were thousands of Ground Zero responders clearing enormous piles of debris and searching for survivors.
Excuse me, Don. I need to interrupt you for just a second here. We allowed 10 to 15 for your conclusion here.
Okay.
How much more time do you think you need?
What am I at now? About 10 minutes, maybe?
Yeah, about 10 or 11.
Okay, I'll just wrap it up here in the next minute. There's some more notes here, but basically the gist of it is, let's wrap this up quick. You can see a picture here. This is taken by Silverstein Properties, and there's a bunch of concentric circles on the one side of the pothole. And get down to the end of it here. The pothole has been called the Grand Canyon of Lower Manhattan. One of the geologists at Hofstra states that it's very unusual to see such features near sea level. And then I'll just skip down to the end of it here. The geologist states that he estimates the rock around the pothole had once been 20 miles below the surface based on the presence of a high-pressure mineral called kyanite. So basically, without a lot of heat and energy and force, you wouldn't get these types of rock formations. And in a natural formation, it would have been 20 miles below the surface, not 110 feet. So I guess we can wrap it up there and take questions.
Okay, thank you, Doc. Hopefully most of you were on the call last week to hear the larger part of Don's presentation, which was include quite a few more details. But among them, there were several challenges, we should say, to prevailing nanothermite theory. And we wanted to give Neil Carrick, who we want to welcome onto the call for the first time, the opportunity to respond to some of these challenges, because he is one of the most recognized experts on the question of nanothermite. So, I would think it would be useful at this point to summarize, go through the points that have been raised. Well, we heard Don tonight say that nanothermite is non-existent, that it was not being produced in large quantities. So maybe we could start with that one and then bring up the others that Don mentioned last week that we've been reviewing on the listserv. And then after that, we can open it up to questions for either Don or Neil's from anybody who would like to speak. Does that sound like a good approach? If there's no objection, Niels, would you like to take that first question then? Don, and anytime, Don, if I'm quoting you wrong, I want you to jump in and let me know that, okay? But Don is essentially arguing that there was no mass production factory for a mass production unit anywhere, that nanothermite was only produced in micro quantities at the time of 9/11, therefore could not have been available in large enough quantities to account for the devastation of the Twin Towers. Is that fairly correct, Don, what you're saying?
Gordon Duff, we were going around with Steve Jones here a couple of weeks ago, and Gordon Duff challenged Christopher Boland to find a factory that had produced this stuff, and apparently he said he found one in Colorado, but Gordon Duff called them up, and they stated, well, they produce regular thermite, and they did try to produce some nanothermite not too long ago, but it basically was not much more explosive than regular thermite, and they only produced maybe a couple of grams of it.
Okay, Niels, can you respond to that, please? Do you think, do you understand? Okay, go ahead.
I'm here.
Thank you.
I'm sitting with a special issue of the Amcheck Quarterly, which is a magazine which Amcheck stands for Advanced Materials and Processes Technology Information Analysis Center. And this is an office out of the United States Department of Defense. And this is from 2002. And this quarterly review is a special issue to DOD researchers. And it's called A Look Inside Nanotechnology. And one of the articles are called Nanoenergetics, an Emerging Technology Area of National Importance. And it actually goes through the potential and the possibilities of producing meter-stable intermolecular composites, which is scientific phrase for nanothermite, or whatever that is. We are in nanotechnology, and a composite material is made up of small particles instead of molecular explosives, in which the reagents actually are within the same molecule, like dynamite. And maybe I can find a few quotes. Meter-stable MICs, this is what they call them, are one of the first examples of a category of nanoscale energetic materials which have been studied and evaluated to a considerable degree. And this has been going on since the early 90s. And maybe another phrase characterizing these materials, and it's actually the principles for their production is very simple, and you can do it in your back garden, as Kevin Ryan has done. And there's a video on the internet how actually you make nanothermite on a modest, not the real hot stuff, of course. But the options, the possibility, the potential of these materials, I quote from this paper from DOD. These include energy output that is 2 times that of typical high explosives. The ability to tune the reactive power, and that is one of the advantages of nanotechnology. You can actually, by procedure and by mixing and other stuff, you can tune the properties of the material to whatever you want. Quote, the ability to tune the reactive power from 10 kV per cubic centimeter to 10 gigawatts per cubic centimeter. Tunable reaction front velocities ranging from 0.1 to 1500 meters per second, and reaction zone temperatures exceeding 3000 degrees Kelvin. And that is that these materials have the potential to cover everything from incendiaries to explosives and intermediates, which you could call propellants or rocket fuel. So they have been around for now more than 20 years, and in military laboratories. Okay. Yeah. I don't think that the military will tell us where the factories are.
Okay. Yeah. Christopher Blinn did send us that PDF a month or so ago, and the highest quoted detonation velocity there was 1,500 meters a second, which is still grossly inadequate for what we see on 9/11. To detonate steel, to pulverize it like that, you need a detonation velocity of at least 6,100 meters a second.
Yeah.
Concrete, 3,200 meters a second.
The fun thing is that actually,
we're
being invited to this one. I'm on here. Somebody's talking about the nanothermite theory about the destruction of World Trade Center. But there is no responsible scientist who has claimed that nanothermite is the sole material responsible for the demolitions. So I'm quite curious, actually, what is the nanothermite theory? Is that the World Trade Center was taken down by nanothermite exclusively? Because then it's for your own account. Nobody has said that. Responsible person.
Well,
okay. What we know actually is that Stephen Jones and cohorts we have found thermitic material in the dust. There is sulfidation of the steel beams, Jonathan Barnett from Worcester Technology, and there is an abundance of iron-rich spheres and 10, 12 other observations, each of which unambiguously points to the application of thermite. So that's what we know. We don't know, and we know that explosives and incendiaries were used. The incendiaries, by necessity, must have been thermitic in origin. We don't know what kinds of explosives were used. They might be conventional, what we call molecular explosives, or they may be thermitic in origin, in design. We don't know that. Okay?
Okay, so in regards to the iron-rich spheres, T. Mark Hightower had a blog post back in 2011 that I reposted on my site, and he states that just to account for all the iron-rich spheres that were at ground zero and all the other devastation, that you would need on the order of 4 kilotons of TNT to explain all that. So how much conventional explosives and nanothermite would you have to add? 4 kilotons? When you start getting into the kiloton range, it's painfully obvious it's nukes.
Okay, do you have clarification? Are you talking about explosives to destroy the steel beams, to destroy iron into tiny fragments, or are you talking about the byproducts of a thermitic material? What is it you're talking about? Could you explain that, please? Thanks.
Oh, okay, the iron-rich spheres that were found at ground zero, there was, it says, okay, and this is a blog post from T. Mark Hightower. He got an email from Mr. Harrett here, and it said that according to Harrett's calculations, this is circa, 2011, that conservatively 11,660 metric tons of iron-rich spheres were present in the dust generated from the destruction of one twin tower. So if we assume that the iron-rich spheres are mostly iron, with the iron source possibly being the structural steel rather than thermitic material, energy required to convert this much iron into the molten state can be calculated. And according to T. Mark Hightower, you're looking on the order of 4 kilotons of TNT equivalent would be required.
This is simply a completely irrelevant, but it is you're referring to a correspondence between me and Mr. Hightower and Jim Fetzer in July 2011, and it's a little weird to hear that Mr. Hightower has put the details from that correspondence into the public domain, because actually, I looked it up prior to this conference, so there's a total of 5 emails. And the second of these to Mr. Hightower, I suggested him to go and calculate how much nanothermite would be needed to explain the value, the foundation of the RGLE group. They found 5.87% iron-rich spheres in the dust. And I suggested to Mr. Hightower that he went back and calculated how much nanothermite would be necessary to produce that number. And he didn't. So I did. This is the third email to Mr. Hightower. Made that calculation. And that was based on the following premises, namely one, that the RGLE group sample was representative for the whole bulk of the World Trade Center dust, and that only one kind of thermite was used for the demolitions, and also that everything was polarized except for the steel beams. And if you go on with these premises, you reach an enormous number. If you assume that the nanothermite contains only 10% iron oxide, you reach 143,000 tons. And if you assume, this number is arbitrary, we don't know this, but if you assume it is 50%, you get 1/5 of that, and this is roughly 30,000 tons nanothermite. Obviously, this is completely ridiculous, out of scale. So I suggested to Mr. Hightower to find the error. There must be an error somewhere here, okay? He didn't. So I came back, this must be email number 4, and this is actually the pertinent email, and I think it's a little, maybe Mr. Hightower and Dr. Fester did not understand what I wrote. This is definitely possible. But obviously, they have been holding this information back. So I suggest, given the time, that I just simply read this email number 4. It's not very long. Mm-hmm. It's a couple of pages. And that is the key to this discussion, okay?
Good.
Are you ready?
Go ahead, Doctor.
Okay. Mr. Hightower. Exactly. You got it. 29,000 tons of thermitic material per tower is a bit out of range. The only explanation, the error if you like, is that the dust in Deutsche Bank, this is footnote here, this is the site where the RGLE group connected their samples, is that the dust in Deutsche Bank cannot be representative for the bulk. We have to look for one, the source producing iron spheres in abundance, and two, a mechanism of selection which directs these spheres into the Deutsche Bank building. If our model can satisfy both conditions, Willem and Ockham will be pleased. Maybe it was a little unfair for me to only include the reference to the RGLE group website, where they claimed the dust was blown through the pedestrian tunnels. A footnote here. On the RGLE group website, they claimed that the dust which got into the Deutsche Bank building was blown through the pedestrian tunnel. But in their report, in the 2003 report, the RGLE group writes, quote, a gash was created in the north side of the building. The plaza in front of the building was crushed, which exposed the level A and level B basement areas and the first floor. Approximately 1,500 windows were broken, and the building was exposed to the elements, as well as being filled with a combination of soot, dust, dirt, debris, and contaminants. Quote ended. This was from the RGLE group. So my email to Mr. Hightower continues. That is, maybe the dust was not blown or sucked into the Deutsche Bank building, but was thrown together with the debris. Actually, I think this is much more probable, and we shall understand, also implied by the iron spheres findings. The selective process was the transportation. Throwing debris and dust takes energy, and tremendous amounts of energy was used to throw steel beams and sections of girders several tons, hundreds of feet through the air from the towers. Obvious for everyone, explosives were used. Footnote, because only explosives can do work. And explosions can even be observed above the impact zone of the South Tower. The observation that iron-rich microspheres were overrepresented in the Deutsche Bank dust could indicate that the explosives doing this mechanical work of throwing debris and dust was thermitic in origin. Late firing explosives were apparently giving the fragments rocket-like properties, as I pointed out to you earlier. And I throw in a footnote, my own here. This letter is from 2011. And I have watched the collapses of the Twin Towers more than 1,000 times because I'm doing many presentations on this. And you have probably done this, everybody on this call has seen the towers collapsing. And you will notice that every fragment being thrown out from the towers is drawing after them a white smoke trail. Now what is that? This is not wallboard, this is not concrete. But just if you just care to watch, I continue my letter to Mr. Hightower here. The fragments all have white tails being released quite regularly. This is not wallboard. Look at the tail from the fragment which makes a 90 degrees turn. This is the South Tower. This is aluminum oxide, the main byproduct of the thermite reactions released by a late firing reaction. So, no surprise. If this is the kind of fragments ending up on the plaza of Deutsche Bank building, one could surely expect an abundance of iron spheres in the dust pouring inside. Therefore, the number one hypothesis is that the explosives used in the towers were thermitic in origin. A second alternative explanation for the high occurrence of iron-rich spheres in Deutsche Bank building could be that incendiaries and molecular explosives were used in concert to destroy the steel frame, thus securing that the iron sphere-rich dust was blown along with the debris, maybe. But we lose the supporting observation of the late firing material covering the ejected fragments. Furthermore, Occam's razor may come in handy here. Thirdly, considering that the dust in Deutsche Bank building was indeed and exclusively blown or sucked into the building through the pedestrian tunnels, as they claim on the IJ Lead Group website. And footnote, maybe the webmaster does not take things as seriously as we do, then we must conclude that some very comprehensive thermitic processes was occurring in the lower sections of the World Trade Center 2, where the pedestrian tunnels presumably start. Whether these events were incendiary or explosive in nature or both, we cannot tell. This is as far as the data bring us. I don't go beyond them. No hypothetical blast scenarios for me, please. In sum, the most probable explanation for the over-representation of the iron spheres in the Deutsche Bank dust is the application of thermitic explosives in World Trade Center 2. There is a wide margin in the numbers for these interpretations. Actually, it is too wide and the numbers still don't add up. But this is only one of the many mysteries waiting for the grand jury. Yours sincerely, Nils Harriet. P.S. Thank you for your sober answer. It contrasts the chill at Hunting and Attacks Abundant in this thread by other authors. Now that was the letter I sent to Mr. Hightower, and apparently it has not reached you, Don. You haven't heard this before, have you? Are you there?
No, I have not. I had myself on mute.
But you have never heard this before.
No, but I think there's a better explanation for the white comet tails coming off the steel beams. Those steel beams were superheated and they're vaporizing as they're getting ejected out.
Excuse me, you're talking about boiling steel beams?
Yeah, and a thermonuclear explosion will get up around 200 million degrees.
So you're saying the steel beams were 200 billion degrees?
For a fraction of a second, some of them were.
Okay.
That's why 1,100 people were vaporized completely. How much thermonuclear?
Hey. 1,100 people were vaporized. Where is the evidence? What are you talking about? And you don't need. You're talking about boiling steel. I mean, I don't even know the boiling point of steel. We must have been 4,000 degrees centigrade or something.
Well, the ground temperature at ground zero was between 600 degrees and 2,000 degrees for 6 months after 9/11.
Fahrenheit.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, but there is absolutely zero evidence for nuclear reactions. None.
Okay. Well, all right. Let's
talk. So maybe we should finish this thing. Okay.
You finish
this,
that now.
This, what I presented here. What I presented here is completely. And actually, this is in 2011. I think that the picture has been, for me personally at least, been much clearer, or not much clearer, but a little clearer. And I presented this in. So what we're dealing with here is more. Like propellants, actually, on the inside of the girders being thrown out from the twin towers, and this is obviously for everyone to see, the white smoke trails. Now, if you say that this is evaporating, this is boiling steel. I'm completely flabbergasted.
Yeah, the term is vaporization.
This is simply too far. I'm sorry.
It's backed up here. Let's talk about the USGS dust samples for a minute. Now, I sent an email to Steve Jones a month ago, and I haven't heard back from him. He sent me some questions, and let's just go over some of that stuff here. Okay, so let's talk about the USGS dust samples.
May I wrap this up? I suggest, well, first, don't you think it's interesting that this last mail to Mr. Hightower didn't reach you? I mean, I'm not aware that I have ever sent you any emails. I was corresponding with Dr. Fetzer and Mr. Hightower. I sure realized that they put somebody on the CC list and probably eventually the BCC list.
No, is that
but you have never heard of this email before to Mr. Hightower. Okay, is that correct?
That is correct.
That is correct. So I suggest, I mean, we could put these three emails, these are my manuscripts for the mails. I don't say the mails. These are my manuscripts for my letter to Mr. Hightower, and Professor Fetzer would definitely be aware of it. Maybe he didn't understand it. Maybe that was a reason for not proceeding it to you. But I suggest that it is added to the minutes from this conference call. So the other people on the call can read it for themselves and make up their mind on this, okay?
Okay, well, let's just briefly talk about what was in the dust. United States Geological Survey collected dust samples within a half mile of ground zero on September 17th and 18th, 2001. And if all you knew about 9/11 was just the common fission products they found in the dust, such as arsenic, rubidium, strontium, barium, yttrium, niobium, molybdenum, silver, cadmium, antimony, cesium, lanthanum, and cerium, you would have to be highly suspicious this was a nuclear event.
Never suspicious.
Because you're seeing, okay, so here's what you're seeing, okay. They also found uranium and thorium.
May I come in here?
Okay, go ahead.
Does everybody here on the conference call know the difference between an element and an isotope? Is there anybody who needs a 5-minute crash course on what is meant by an element and what is meant by an isotope, what the words mean? No? So everybody knows what an element and an isotope is. And eventually, a radioisotope is an isotope which is emitting radiation, it's decaying. And this is what you're looking for after a nuclear event.
Yes, and that's exactly what
we're saying. Just rambling up names of elements from the periodic table.
Well, why don't you
absolutely meaningless.
Why don't you let me finish, Mr. Herod?
Well, I just want to make things clear.
Well, good. Instead of attacking, let's just get through the presentation here.
Well, if nobody
wait a minute, Don. You were supposed to have concluded your presentation.
I just want to counter some of the stuff he's throwing out there. I've got just a sample of an email here I sent to Steve Jones a month ago. And this, it's not, okay, so the USGS does samples. You don't have isotopic data. That is true. So what you have to do is you have to look at the whole picture of these elements and what's going on. And then you can see these relationships. You can see the fission fragments decaying. Let's just talk about strontium and iodine. So iodine 131 has a half-life of 8.0197 days, and it decays into xenon 131. Iodine 131 is a major fission product. We did not see iodine 131 at the dust samples, the USGS, but we do see thorium. Iodine-131 was detected in the Hudson River samples that were taken a month after 9/11. Strontium was found at very high levels in the dust samples, basically off the charts, and so was barium. And true barium and strontium, you might find them in building debris, but no way are you going to find them at 3,000 parts per million. Nobody could build a building that was made out of that much barium and strontium. So we see uranium fissioning down into barium and strontium, and then from there we can see strontium decaying into yttrium. It undergoes strontium 90 is a radioactive isotope of strontium. So if you have a nuclear fission event, which we have all the telltale signs of at ground zero, that'll undergo beta minus decay and it'll decay into yttrium 90, and we do see yttrium in the dust samples. Yttrium should not be found in the dust of a collapsed office building. And yttrium 90 is produced by a chemical high purity separation from strontium 90, a fission product of uranium in nuclear reactors.
But it wasn't there. We didn't see it.
Yttrium is in the dust samples.
But strontium 90, what's the half-life of strontium 90?
The half-life of strontium 90 is 28.8 years.
So it should be abundant even today. And it irradiates, and it's that's true. That is a fission product from uranium 2035. So is cobalt 60. So is technetium. So is iodine. And the radiation from these radionuclides is very, very easily detectable. And there's been absolutely no reading of any radioactivity, and we can go through all what you mentioned here. There's no radiation after a nuclear bomb exploding.
Uranium and thorium are always radioactive, and uranium and thorium were found in the dust sample.
Not true. Uranium 238 is stable. We're talking about uranium 235, which is a fissionable product. And when it decays, you can go buy with a Geiger counter, you can buy in a toy store.
And it would simply go off scale. And they
banned
Geiger counters at ground zero. And
pardon?
They banned Geiger counters at ground zero.
Yeah. Paul Lior has investigated dust samples, and he has with a very sensitive instrument, went through all the fission products from uranium, from plutonium, from thorium, you know, the three main decay series from radioactive material. He found absolutely zero activity. Zero. We don't detect anything.
I don't believe anything Steve Jones says.
Well, this is a publication from Paul Lyon. This is a peer-reviewed publication. Unfortunately, due to vacation here, it's in my office at the university. So I couldn't get the original. I don't have access to the library here from home. So I don't have the original paper in my hand. But this is, I can give you the reference, you can go and look it up. I mean, and this is official. There is absolutely zero. So one thing is that you do not have any evidence supporting your claim. You have zero evidence for claiming that there were nuclear events. The other thing is that your theory is violating reality, because this is not what you see. So one thing is you don't have any support. Another thing is you're violating what everybody can see, actually, thousands of small explosions going down the tower. But we can discuss the tritium levels if you want on the building 6 and stuff.
Yes, tritium is always radioactive, and tritium was found at levels 55 times above background 11 days after 9/11.
That's not true.
Yes, it is true.
Okay. I'm sitting with this paper, which are authored by 7 workers from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. It came out October 1st, 2002. Studies of tritium at the World Trade Center.
Yep.
And they measured how many samples did they take? I just have to go to, I'm having it here, 51 samples around ground zero under the Twin Towers and downwind from ground zero. In 49 of these measurements, they were simply below detection level. Okay. And now we have to actually bring in some numbers, because the average value of tritium in water everywhere in the United States is between 0.1 and 0.2 nanocuries per liter. So all these were below detection. Of these 51, the 48 were below detection level. Now the one from the Twin Towers was detectable, but it was still a value of 0.164 nanocuries per liter. This is the average value for the United States, okay? Meaning that there was no tritium below the Twin Towers. The Twin Towers are out. Only 2 readings, and they came out of the basement, the World Trade Center 6, was noticeable. And the value here was 3.8, roughly, in average, 3 nanocuries per liter, which is, 20 times above the average number, what you, any water sample in the United States. What did you say? 30 times? Make it 20. Let's meet at 20. 20 times.
It's actually, Edward did the calculations. I'm looking at them here. It's 54.63 times normal background level.
Well, then we have to argue what is normal. Yeah, background level. Yeah, but what is the normal value you find in the United States? That's what I'm counting on here.
Okay, well, Ed even...
It really doesn't matter, because we are in a range which is totally ridiculous. We are...
Okay, totally ridiculous. Okay, that's a completely ad hominem attack. I just gave you all the elements of fission products, and then we have tritiated water in the basement of Building 6. Tritium is an extremely rare hydrogen isotope.
That's not true. It's all over. It's everywhere. But
what percentage of hydrogen is tritium?
We have to make a calculation from curie to...
Yeah, it's 10 to the minus 16th.
Okay. That's abundant. I mean, so if you have 1 liter of water, there's plenty of tritium in it. But, okay. So we can discuss what is rare. Yeah, it is rare, but it is.
Yeah, it's produced by cosmic rays hitting the upper atmosphere.
Yeah, and the fallout from the hydrogen bomb experiments in the
future. Yeah, much more is from hydrogen bomb fallout than what is produced by cosmic rays.
Yeah.
And so, anthropogenic source is account for the dominant portion of global tritium, the global tritium inventory.
So maybe we should continue with this paper that we're discussing, because then they notice that if the only thing here is World Trade Center 6. I mean, the twin towers are out now. So we're talking about 6, and they find this value in the basement. And for comparison, they calculate how much tritium was on board the Boeing 767. And in the airplanes, there was, you know, because the emergency lights in the airplanes, they contain tritium. They use the tritium decay for making emergency exit lights. And it was, I think it was 30 curies on board the airline. And we are 1 billion below that value here. So in the basement of World Trade Center, 1 billion, 1 nanocurie is 1 billionth of a curie, and there was about 30 curies on board the airliner. So just to give the people here on the call a feel for the scale we are operating here. It's completely, the total activity from the aircraft was 34 curies at the time of the attack. They can calculate that. When the airliner is produced in 1933, it was 43 curies of tritium in emergency science, and then decays over the years. And so at 9/11, it was 34 curies at the time of the attack.
Okay,
this is 1 billion more on board the airliner than what you find in the
paper. There's a bunch of problems with the exit sign theory. First of all, no one's proved that a commercial plane actually hit either Twin Tower. So I'm gonna challenge you on that. Prove to me that one of an actual commercial plane actually hit a twin tower with an exit sign. And B, even if that did occur, how is tritium from the twin towers going to get into the basement of Building 6?
It didn't. So and then they also ruled that out. I mean, they actually devote several pages on trying to figure out where it comes from.
The exit sign theory. So we can dismiss exit signs as being the source of the tritium.
Yeah, but it's still ridiculous. Then it's still the way
ridiculous.
We,
ridiculous.
It's the numbers are ridiculous because you're looking for watches, you're looking for weaponry with night sights, and there was actually a stock room for weaponry.
Yeah, all the guns were found intact, so none of the night sights didn't leak.
Well, they didn't write this in this paper. But nevertheless, I mean, that is where we are. We are looking for watches and night sights to explain this value. Excuse me, let me finish this. How much tritium do you think gets out of we're talking about a hydrogen bomb here. Do you think there was any sewer at all if you fire a hydrogen bomb? You think that you can flush out a hydrogen bomb through the toilet, through the sewers? You can flush out a hydrogen bomb?
Okay, remember, these samples were taken 11 days after 9/11. It had rained twice, and firemen had sprayed, what did they spray? They sprayed...
4 million gallons.
Yep, 4 million gallons of water.
3 million gallons for the firemen and 1 million gallons from the showers. And you have a big hole in the ground, and there's a lot of things lying around. Do you think you can stir that? Don't you think it could be an isolated pocket with a wrist watch? That's all it takes to get this value. If there was one broken watch lying in the basement where they took the sample, it explains everything. And you're flushing out a hydrogen bomb through the sewers.
Niels, okay, so let's take a wristwatch, and then we'll spray 4 million gallons of water in the basement. How much tritium is going to be left 11 days later?
Depending on how much stirring you actually have. I'm not saying that you can dilute. We are really on the fringe here. The numbers are totally out of your hydrogen bomb. You have plasma temperatures to 1 million degrees centigrade just to get it started. And you need a fission bomb to start a hydrogen bomb. And there is no other reason.
Evidence. There's plenty of evidence for fission at ground zero.
Zero. There's absolutely no evidence. You have ranted names of elements from the periodic table.
Yes.
We need radioisotopes. Where is the beef? Where is the radioisotopes? Where is the radiations? There is zero. There is none.
Okay, so why did all these people get cancer?
There are many reasons for having cancer. But the radiation, when you have a bomb event, there is a blast coming out of the moment. Okay, and that is neutrons. There's neutrons, and you have X-rays, and you have gamma rays. They have some range. The beta rays and the alpha rays are very short range because they're getting absorbed by the air. But the neutrons and the gamma rays and the X-rays, they reach pretty far. You get what you call radiation illness sickness from that. And that is immediate. People, if you walk into Fukushima, you get ill very, very soon. And that is true over the years. If you have been exposed to radiation, you get, say, thyroid cancer and some kinds of leukemia, which is very specific for radiation. But the people who are getting these cancers, actually, they're much more indicative of having inhaled the dust.
So we don't have to explain why
people get cancer.
They've got Hiroshima effect cancers, and approximately 70,000 New Yorkers now have applied for compensation.
Yeah.
So
70,000 people, Niels.
Yeah.
And let's just go back to the tritium for a sec. So I'm looking at Ed Ward's calculations here. So had not all that water been sprayed into the basement of Building 6, Ed Ward calculates that 6.12 billion tritium units would have been found. And that level is on the level of a leaking nuclear power plant. 6.12 billion tritium units, Niels.
Yeah, but you don't have hydrogen. You don't have fusion in the power plant.
Tritiated water is...
You don't have fusion power still, until further. You don't have fusion in the power plant. You only have fission. Okay?
We have the fission-triggered fusion bomb.
Yeah. The deuterium comes out of a hydrogen bomb. And you have to get to 1 million degrees centigrade in order to start a hydrogen bomb.
That's why you have a fission trigger.
Right. And the fission triggers leaves behind.
Leaves behind exactly what we see in the USGS dust samples. We see barium and strontium. Those are very common fission products.
No, no.
Yeah.
You don't see any fission products. You're ranting off the series of products.
Look, Niels, you guys are done, okay? We know all about you. This data is going to get out. It's already starting to. You guys have no credibility.
So this is Wayne here. Can we figure out a final way to close out this particular question, the section? I actually have a follow-up from the last call that I'd like to address, and like Niels to be online also. Over.
Okay, fair enough. This was supposed to be question and answer from the participants.